So, just like that.
Yep.
Sorry. Yeah.
Well, you know, when I bought my first house in North Carolina, I read an article in the newspaper which was making fun of people who paid somebody to cut their lawn and then went to the gym.
Yeah.
And so I decided I will cut my own lawn. So for a few years I cut my own lawn. But later I paid somebody to cut my lawn for me.
Climbing to the school and then getting on a bicycle.
Yeah.
Suddenly a dawn.
Do I need to do anything to this?
No.
No.
All
John seminar today with the geometry seminar with Dave seminar, and we are happy to have Xiaodong Cao from Cornell University also hosting MSRI. And Xiaodong will tell us about the cross curvature flow on locally homogeneous Riemann folds.
Thanks. First, I want to thank the organizers for kind invitation, especially for Professor Dai and Professor Wei for their kind of hospitality. And it's really a very beautiful campus here. And I swear that although you can see that I'm from Cornell University, but I have nothing to do with the rain and the snow here. Okay. I actually came from MSRI, so. So today I'm going to talk about the cross curvature flow on locally homogeneous three manifold. And this is a joint work with Yilong Ni at University of Oklahoma and my colleague Roland Soloff Koester at Cornell University. So first, let me give an outline of my talk today here. We will talk a little bit about the notations that we are going to use, and then we will give a brief introduction to the cross curvature flow. And then we will talk a little bit about locally homogeneous three manifolds. And finally, we will study the cross curvature flow on locally homogeneous three manifolds. So, throughout today's talk, we will use M to denote a closed three-manifold, dimension for dimension equal to 3. And we will use G to denote a remaining metric on M. And we use G lower ij to denote the component for the remaining metric. And we use G up ij to denote the inverse of the matrix G lower ij. And we use rij just as in the rich flow to denote the rich curvature. The scalar curvature is defined as a trace of the rich curvature. And we use EIJ to denote the Einstein tensor, which is equal to the rich curvature minus half of scalar curvature times GIJ. And in our talk, we will use P up IJ to denote the Einstein tensor, which we raise the indices. And we use VIJ to denote the inverse of the Einstein tensor. And then we can define what we call a cross-curvature tensor as a determinant of the Einstein tensor over determinants of the metric times VIJ. So this is the definition for the cross-curvature tensor. And we use capital X to denote the trace of the cross-curvature tensor. And
So VIJ is not always defined.
It's not always defined. So when I talk, when I was saying inverse of PIJ, I mean when there's such an inverse. And in fact, a little bit later, we will see why we can always talk about the VIJ. And in our talk, FI goes from 1, 2, 3, denote an orthogonal frame, while EI goes from 1, 2, 3, denote an orthonormal frame. So first, like Professor Moore pointed out, that for our definition, VIJ is not always defined. So one case that we are going to talk about today is when the sectional curvature has a definite sign. So either all the sectional curvature are all positive, or all the sectional curvature are all negative. Then the inverse of PIJ is defined, because in this case, if you look at the Einstein tensor, it's just the minus of the sectional curvatures. Okay, then you always have a definite sign, so you can talk about its inverse. Now, let's look at in local orthonormal frame. So here we are talking about the orthonormal frame, which diagonalizes the rich curvature and also the cross curvature. So assume the principal sectional curvature here are k1, k2, k3. Now, what happened to the rich curvature? We know that the rich curvature is just a sum of the principal curvature. On the other hand, the cross curvature tensor is also a combination of the principal curvatures. But here, instead of the sum of two principal curvatures, it's the product of the two principal curvatures. Okay, so we can see that from this relation that the cross curvature tensor and the rich curvature tensor are closely related. But if you look at the flow a little bit later, we will see that the equation for the cross curvature flow will be a little bit more complicated than the rich flow equation, because the rich flow here, you can see it's the sum of the two curvature, but now you get the product of the two curvatures. And the advantage of this equivalent definition is, even remember a minute ago, we know that we have to have the sectional curvature have a definite sign to define the cross curvature tensor. But here, with this definition, we know that even the one or two sectional curvature vanishes, we still can define the cross curvature tensor. So, just like the rich flow, we are going to evolve the metric by equation. Here, we are going to evolve the metric by what we call the cross curvature flow equation. So, if the sectional curvature is positive, then we evolve the metric by minus 2 xij. And if the sectional curvature is negative, then we evolve the metric by 2 times xij. The choice of the sign is because of the we want this flow to be a parabolic equation. So this is exactly why we need to choose the sign for different sign of sectional curvatures. So, well, since we're working closely on the cross curvature flow compared to the rich flow, so we know for the rich flow, when we talk about convergence, we usually talk about the convergence and the normalized rich flow. So normalized rich flow means when you fix the volume and the flow. So here, of course, we can also talk about the normalized cross curvature flow. However, the rescaling is a little bit different in this case. So of course, the first thing you do is you rescale in space such that the volume and the flow is fixed. So you basically, you multiply the metric by a function phi, which is only a function of time. And then you need to reparametrize the time by a different factor. So in the rich flow, if you remember, this t tilde is integration of phi t dt. But here, because of the different cross-curvature tensor, we have to rescale the time by phi integration of phi square. So by using this rescaling, and we can verify that the metric g tilde and the new time t tilde satisfy the following equation, which we call the normalized cross-curved equation. And I take away the tilde just to make the equation look simple. So if the sectional curvature is positive, then our normalized cross-curved flow equation satisfies ddt equal to minus 2 xij plus 2 over 3 x bar gij. So x bar is the average of the trace of the cross-curvature tensor over the manifold. In the case when the sectional curvature is negative, we have a different normalized cross-curvature flow equation. So again, x bar is just the average of the trace. Okay. So these are the normalized cross-curvature flow. Again, well, let me just remind you one more time. So this is just like the rich flow, the normalized equation and the unnormalized equation only differ by a rescaling in space. So let's first look at the steady solutions for the cross curvature flow equation. Of course, if you look at the unnormalized cross curvature flow equation, we can the right hand side is just the minus 2 xij. So either we have a flat metric or we have a product metric. So when you have a product metric, you have two sectional curvatures are zero. So here, if we use the equivalent definition, we know the cross curvature tensor actually vanish. Okay. Now, in the case when we talk about the normalized cross curvature flow equation, and the right hand side is if the right hand side is equal to zero, then we have xij equal to 1 over 3 x bar gij. And we call this Einstein. So not surprisingly, we know easily we can show that the Einstein metric must be Einstein. So this over a compact manifold, it's easy to show that. And of course, here we assume that the cross curvature tensor does not vanish. So, well, we know that the rich soliton plays an important role in the study of rich flow. So, what happens if we just don't have the steady solution, but instead we have these soliton solutions? For simplicity, let's just talk about compact gradient solitons. Compact gradient solitons for the cross curvature flow equation satisfy this equation xij plus fij equal to a multiple times of gij. And here fij means the hashing of the of some scalar function f. And since the manifold is compact, we can take trace on both sides. And we know when we have a definite sign of the sectional curvature, the cross curvature tensor must be positive definite. So if you take trace on both sides and take an integration, then the term, if you look at the hashing of f, take trace, there will be Laplacian, take integration, there will be zero. So this tells you that the constant c has to be positive. In other words, for gradient solitons and the cross curvature tensor, the soliton equation xij plus fij equal to cgij, the right hand side, has to be positive. Now this is different from the case in the rich flow, because if I think many of you are experts now in the study of rich flow, you know that the rich soliton equation, gradient rich soliton equation, satisfy rij plus fij equal to a lambda gij, and the lambda can be positive, zero, negative, which corresponding to shrinking soliton, static soliton, and expanding soliton. But here, the soliton equation is we only have one equation, and the right hand side has to be positive. So now, let me quickly remind you the relation between cross curvature flow and the rich flow. Usually, people view those two flows as dual flows to each other. And the reason is the following, that people view the cross curvature tensor and the rich tensor as dual to each other. So it is a lemma of Richard Hamilton that if you have a three-dimensional Riemannian manifold with positive or negative sectional curvature, then as we denote that the cross curvature tensor is positive definite. So the identity map from M3x to M3g is a harmonic map. Now, it is a classical result that if you have a n-dimensional Riemannian manifold and with positive or negative rich curvature, then the identity map from mg to mn to the rich curvature is a harmonic map. So in this sense, the cross curvature tensor and the rich curvature tensor is viewed as dual to each other. And for the same reason, the cross curvature flow and the rich flow are viewed as dual flow to each other. So when we study the cross curvature flow, we expect that there will be a lot of similarity between the cross curvature flow and the rich flow. Of course, there will be also a lot of difference between them. So, of course, when we have a geometrical evolution equation, the first question we can ask is, do we have short time existence? If you gave an initial metric, does the flow actually exist for some short time? So this was first proved by Richard Hamilton and Ben Chao in 2004, and then quickly by Buckland in 2005 using de Turk's trick. So suppose you have a closed three manifold with negative or positive sectional curvature. Then for any smooth initial metric, there always exists a solution to the cross curvature flow.
What's the difference between the two groups? The
original proof used the Nash-Moss theorem, which Hamilton used to prove the existence of rich flow. But the proof of Buckland just used the de Turk's trick, which again simplifies.
Strange. the group trip was well known already.
I believe the paper was published in 2004, but the short time existence actually was obtained by Bencher and Hamilton about more than 20 years ago. But they
just kept it the way it
was. They just didn't have a application for the whole project they have. So I think you're right. By the time 2004, they could have thought using the Dirac's trick to prove the short time existence. Yes. I think Buckland is a student of Ben Andrews. So no, Ben Andrews.
Andrews.
So. Well, the motivation for the study of cross-curvature flow comes the following conjecture. Well, of course, it's a more well-known or general conjecture in hyperbolic geometry. So suppose we have a closed three manifold with negative sectional curvature. Then first, if you consider the normalized cross-curvature flow, they conjecture that the solution exists for all time. And moreover, they conjecture that the solution will converge to a constant negative sectional curvature as t goes to infinity. You can ask the same question if you start with a positive sectional curvature metric. So let me quickly reveal history about positive curvature and negative curvature. We know that in 1982, Hamilton showed that for any closed three manifold which admits a metric of positive rich curvature, it must be diffeomorphic to a standard sphere. And if we consider sectional curvature, then there is the famous Cotter-Pinchin theorem by Klingberg, Roach, and Berger. So they prove that any simply connected manifold which has a sectional curvature satisfying the condition between a quarter and a one must be homeomorphic to a sphere. And if you get more strong conditions, in 1986, Hamilton shows that for any closed four-dimension remaining manifolds which has a positive curvature operate, then it must diffeomorphic to a standard sphere. Of course, I have to also remind you it's a theorem of Professor Moore and his collaborators that if you assume that if the metric has a positive isotropic curvature, then it's homeomorphic to the sphere too. Okay. And now recently, most recently, in 2006, Baum and Wilkin prove that for any remaining compact remaining manifold with positive curvature operate, it must be spaceful. Okay, which is of course a very strong result. So this tells us the positive curvature actually are very well. The positive curvature metric are very rigid. On the other hand, we can look at the negative curvatures. It was a result of Gao and Yao in 1986, which they show that for any closed three manifold, you can always find a metric with negative rich curvature. In other words, if you consider negative rich curvature, it has no topological restrictions to the manifold. And later in 1994, Lohan shows that every closed M manifold admits a metric with negative rich curvature for all dimensions at least three. On the other hand, when you consider sectional curvatures, then it's a result of Gromov and Thurston in 1987. So if you look at a dimension at least four, there exist close remaining manifolds with arbitrary pinched negative sectional curvature, but they do not admit metric of constant sectional curvature. So this means the conjecture of Banchell and Richard Hamilton, you can only hope that works in dimension three. For high dimensions, you don't have such hope to work. So now we have our parabolic flow, and we know we have a short time existence. So the first question, of course, is since we have this assumption of negativity of sectional curvature, so the first question, of course, will be will the negativity of the sectional curvature preserve the end of the cross curvature flow? Unfortunately, we don't have an affirmative answer to this question right now, but we have some partial answer. So if you consider the volume of the Einstein tensor, which is defined as the integration of square root determinant of the Einstein tensor over determinant of the metric. Now the first thing you notice is this volume of the Einstein tensor is a scale invariant quantity. If you rescale the metric, then the volume form rescale. If you rescale the metric by a constant C, then the volume form rescale like C to the 3 over 2, and then you can look at the inside of the square root, it rescale like C to the minus 3. So the whole thing is a scale invariant. And moreover, it is a monotone and the cross curvature flow. So if you have a three manifold with negative sectional curvature, then you can show that volume of the Einstein tensor is non-decreasing and the cross curvature flow. Using these, Banchell and Richard Hamilton are able to prove the following result, that if you have a three-dimensional remaining manifold, and suppose GT is a solution to the cross-curved flow. We also assume that the flow only exists up to a finite time, so that means we have a finite time singularity. And furthermore, we need to assume this inf of determinant of Einstein tensor over the metric is equal to zero. So what does this condition mean? Remember, determinant of the Einstein tensor basically is the absolute value of the product of the sectional curvatures. So if you assume the sectional curvatures are lambda 1, lambda 2, lambda 3, then the determinant of the set is just a minus lambda 1, lambda 2, lambda 3. So if the inf goes to 0, that means at least one of them, lambda 1, should go to 0. Then they can show that the metric preserves the negativity of the sectional curvature for all time from 0 to t. And you can find a sequence of points and a time, xi, ti, such that as ti goes to capital T, then you have, if you have this, such that you can find the smallest principal sectional curvature goes to infinity, and the largest principal sectional curvature goes to zero. And because, as I mentioned, the determinant is equal to the product of those three, since the inf is goes to zero. So this means the one goes to zero, the rate of the one goes to zero is much faster than the one goes to infinity. Okay. So these are the all we know about the preservation of the negativity of sectional curvature. Remember, in the rich flow, in dimension 2, when a positive curvature is preserved, negative curvature is also preserved.
Excuse me, you said before it's unknown whether negativity of sectional curvature is preserved or not.
So this result tells us the negative.
But how does the assumption on the entailment enter into the argument? If you stay just a little bit away from t, that assumption won't help you. But you still, if you apply the theorem, you still know sectional curvature is negative, or it is not what it implies.
No, so basically this theorem tells you the negativity of the sectional curvature is preserved unless there's a singularity happen. So if you can show that the sectional curvature is bounded from above and below,
then
you always know the negativity is preserved.
But that means sectional negativity is preserved really along the flow.
But we have this additional assumption here.
That's something I don't understand, because that equals zero, as you said, really just means. What does that mean?
But the singularity happen does not guarantee you have this equal to zero.
Does that mean T is a singularity?
Capital T.
Does that mean that?
Capital T is where the maximum solution exists.
T is what? T is the Einstein tensor.
Yes.
The determinant Einstein tensor being zero doesn't mean you have singularity.
It means lambda, well, lambda 1, lambda 2, lambda 3 equal to 0. Remember, when we define the cross-curvature tensor, we need it has to be a positive definite.
Right.
So if there's a lambda 1 goes to 0.
So in other words, what is known is as long as
the flow is defined.
Flow is defined, the
yes.
Negativity is preserved.
Yes.
Right. So that's what I wanted to make sure.
Yeah, yes. But we do have this extra condition here. Yes, exactly. So now let me talk a little bit about the geometry of locally homogeneous Riemann-manifold. So a Riemann-manifold is called locally homogeneous if for any two points you can find a neighborhood and there is an isometry from one to the other one and which maps x to y, then we say it's a locally homogeneous manifold. And in the case when the isometric group acts transitively on the Riemann manifold, then we say the whole the manifold MG is homogeneous. In other words, in the previous definition, we can always extend the neighborhood to the whole manifold. Okay. So in the case, yes.
Would you mind showing the previous slide one more time?
You mean the one? This one?
Yeah.
Sure.
So the theorem covers only one type of singularity, right? Namely,
namely, if you have this inf.
It doesn't cover the singularity like in Ricci for a blow-up singularity.
No,
right.
No. Because in fact, let me quickly get into the details. So you need to use the maximum principle,
right.
But to use the maximum principle, there's some term you don't know how to control, and this condition actually tells you how to control those terms. So it's quite analytic. It's not general geometric assumption. So if you assume the manifold is simply connected, then it's a theorem of Singer in the 60s that locally homogeneous and homogeneous Riemann manifold are equivalent. So now because the cross, like the rich flow, the cross-curvature flow commutes with the projection map. So we can always work on the universal curve. Okay. And so we only need to deal with the universal curves. In dimension 3, the there are 9 possibilities for the universal cover, which we can label them by the minimal isometric group, which acts transitively. The first group is H3, SO3 cross R, and H2 cross R. And the second group is R3, SU2, SCR2R, and Heisenberg, E11, and E2. And we also call the second group as Bianchi type. Okay. So let me remind you that the case of rich flow on locally homogeneous three-manifold was studied by James Eisenberg and Martin Jackson in 1992. And in both cases, the rich flow and the cross-curved flow on locally homogeneous three-manifolds, the PDE, because the PDE system becomes an ODE system. And this is why we can do all the analysis here. So our calculation are all based on the following theorem of John Milnor. So suppose you have a three-dimensional unimodular Lie group, and let G be the Lie algebra of the left invariant vector fields. And I use a third G to denote the left invariant metric. So in 1976, Milnor proved the following. First, there exists a positive oriented orthonormal basis, E1, E2, E3, and real number lambda 1, lambda 2, lambda 3, such that the Brecht operation of the Lie algebra has the following form. Okay. And such a basis always diagonalizes the rich curvature tensor and also the cross-curvature tensor. And if you take a different basis, if you take Fi equal to AjAkEi with some non-zero numbers, then the Brecht operation can be written in the following way. So now, choose up to orientation, you can make sure that at most one of the lambda I is negative. Moreover, Milnor shows that for any given initial metric G0, we can always choose a basis F1, F2, F3, and we can choose Fi, which is collinear to the EI we chose before. And the Lie algebra has the Brecht operation like Fi Fj equal to 2 times epsilon k Fk, where epsilon k is choosing from minus 1, 0, and a positive one. Okay. And such frame are called a Milnor frame for the metric G0. And we also use eta I goes from 1, 2, 3 to denote the dual frame of the Milnor frame. Then the left invariant metric G can always be written in a diagonal form, that is A eta. You can always find the positive number ABC such that the metric G is written in the following way. And we already know that the Milnor frame diagonalizes the rich curvature tensor and the cross curvature tensor. So if you study the rich flow on the locally homogeneous three manifold or cross curvature flow on the locally homogeneous flow, you know that this form of the metric is always preserved. So this is why the PDE system becomes become a system of ODE, which which is much simpler to analysis. So the rest of today's talk will deal with cross-curved flow on locally homogeneous three-manifold. First, let's start with some trivial cases. of course, if we start with R3, then all the metrics are flat metrics, so the sectional curvature are zero. You use the equivalent definition, you know, cross curvature tensor is zero. So the metric does not change at all and the cross curvature flow. Now, if you look at the case of hyperbolic geometry, well, all the metric in this group has constant negative curvature. So metric is a multiple of the standard hyperbolic metric. But in this case, we cannot use the cross curvature flow itself. We use the normalized cross curvature flow. Then we know the metric does not change and the normalized cross curvature flow. In the case SO3 cross R1, we know the metric in this group has to be a product metric. As we mentioned before, when you have a product metric, you have at least two sectional curvatures are zero. So the cross curvature tensor vanishes again. So the metric does not change in this case. Same thing happened to the case when you have H2 cross R1. Again, the metric in this group has to be a product metric. So the cross curvature tensor has to be vanished. So, as we mentioned before, for the cross curvature flow, we have two different choices of the sign. One is we pick the negative sign when sectional curvature is positive, and we pick the positive sign when the sectional curvature is negative. So, in today's talk, I mean, unless we have time, otherwise we will deal with an unnormalized negative cross curvature flow. Okay. And we will only talk about the normalized cross curvature flow if there's a huge difference in geometry. So first case, we will deal with the cross curvature flow on Heisenberg, so on new manifold. So we can calculate the rich curvature in this case, and we can also calculate the cross curvature tensor, which can be written in the following way. So now we can write out the cross curvature flow equation as three ODEs, and this is the simplest case because we are very fortunate we can solve this ODE system precisely. And we can write the solution as follows. So here we can see that the first thing we can see is the solution exists for all time. Because if you look at the solution, there's no singularity happen. So the solution exists all time, and we can also get an estimate for the sectional curvatures. The sectional curvature behaves like 1 plus t to the power minus 1 over 2. So as t goes to infinity, the sectional curvature vanishes. And so that means the cross curvature flow develop a pancake degeneracy, which means you have two diameter which increase to infinity and the other diameter shrinks to zero. And at the same time you have the curvature dies off. Let me remind you that in the case of rich curvature on new manifold, which was studied by Eisenberg and Jackson, they also proved that the rich flow develop a pancake degeneracy in the case of rich flow. Now, in this case, let me just say a little bit more. So we know that a closed Riemann manifold is called epsilon flat if the sectional curvature times the diameter square is bounded by epsilon. Okay. And if the above is true for all epsilon, then we call the manifold is almost flat. It was proved by Gromov that in all dimensions, a manifold is almost flat if and only if it's covered by a new manifold. So here, by using the cross-curved flow, we verify that this is almost a flat manifold, because we can calculate the sectional curvature times the diameter square is like 1 plus t to the power minus 2 over 7. So as t goes to infinity, you can see the approach to 0. The second case is we study the cross curvature flow on SU2. Now we know that on SU2 there is an Einstein metric, which is the constant curvature metric. So, well, if we hope that the conjecture of Cho and Hamilton is true, then our cross curvature flow should flow to this metric. So we first calculate that in this case, of course our calculation based on Milne's theorem, that the rich curvature satisfies the following. The rich curvature looks like this, and then we can write the cross curvature tensor in the following way, which looks a little bit complicated than the previous case. And then we can write out the cross curvature flow as follows. And then what we need to do is just estimate the ODE system. So what we can show is the following. For any initial data, A0, B0, and C0, the solution of the cross curvature flow always exists up to some finite time. And as t goes to capital T, the A, B, and C approach to behave like 2 times square root capital T minus T. So this is, of course, is for the unnormalized cross curved flow. Now, if you, well, we hope this converges to the constant sectional curvature matrix. So when we talk about the convergence, we of course want to work in the normalized cross curved flow. So we can also calculate that all the sectional curvature behave like 1 over 2 times square root t minus t. Then if we work on the normalized cross curvature flow, we can show first that the flow exists all time, and then we can show that the sectional curvature actually become a constant. And in fact, you can easily see that the scaling part is 1 over 2 times square t, capital T minus T. So that means ABC actually goes to a constant.
How does this sectional curvature become constant?
Well, if you do this rescaling, if you rescale the metric by 1 over 2 times square root capital T minus T, then the sectional curvature scales like
in the first line, you already know sectional curvature are all approximate like that. So I guess my question is, how do you do that? That follow from ABC?
Just calculate. Just calculate. If you recall in my previous slides, I can work out the rich curvature. I didn't write out the formula for the sectional curvature, but I can all calculate out. So in this case, I just write out the sectional curvature, and then I just look at the.
So the reason that all A, B, C have the same asymptotic, that's because of the satisfy same kind of equations?
Yes and no. Well, here, if you look at, yes, because if you look at the equation here, A, B, and C are very symmetric. But symmetric, which we later will discover, symmetry does not mean that you will you will keep the, if you start with some symmetry, it does not mean that you always keep that. So no just means, even you look at ABCR in symmetrical place, that doesn't mean in the asymptotic
behavior. Basically, how do you derive the asymptotics? No, let's not worry about whether it's the same asymptotics. For example, how do you get asymptotics for A? Of course, you do that all together, but what's the
See, basic idea is you look at case by case and see what you can do to the equation. For example, here, let me quickly see what I can see here. So, well, of course, you start with the assumption. Let's assume A at least larger than B, larger than C. Then you look at okay, so that means X is positive and something like that, and you look at the equation. So,
but you don't actually solve the equation.
I cannot actually solve the equation.
So how do you get the asymptotics? By some comparison theorems?
Basically, we just just like you say. In some case, actually, in later it will be very complex. We have to divide case by case. So for each case, we do the estimate.
But in the end, I think maybe you still in the end have to do some comparison.
Yes. For example,
because you don't want to, you can't find a solution explicitly.
No.
So you have to do some kind of things like maximum principle comparison.
For example, we can look at the quantity A times B to the minus 3. And for example, we can show for some reason this the derivative of such thing goes to 0. So the whole thing goes to a constant. I'm not saying exactly in this case, but this is how we do. Then we know asymptotically A is approach to C over B3, then we can plug this back into the equation and see what we can say more, and this is what we...
So you didn't do any comparison with some model ODE?
No.
So just cook up the correct quantities?
Yes. That's all we do.
But still, how does this quantity on the right-hand side arise in that arc manipulation? Like you said, you prove A is like something divided by B, something.
Mm-hmm.
That still doesn't give you T minus T.
No, but if you analyze the ODE system more, then you get more information. Finally, you will get an equation only involves A, then you know A looks like something.
So then you will still have to do some estimates to throw out, because in each of the equation you have more than A, right?
You have all A, B, and C, right. Yes.
So in the end, you can reduce to the equation involving A alone?
In some case, yes. I don't remember exactly what I did before.
By doing some estimates,
yes.
From above?
Yeah, like I said, I can, for example, I can show A times B cubed is some constant. Then basically you can reduce the equation a little bit. And then for each case, you have to work on case by case. There's no general theory here. And in fact, in some cases, you can only show, okay, this is bounded. But bounded also gave you some information, then you can show some other things. So there's no standard model ODE here to use.
But just find a little surprising that you get the same asymptotics for A, B, C, and E.
Yes. But more surprising, I will tell you a little bit, if you change the sign, then you will get different behaviors. So I hope I have enough time to tell you that. So if you work on the normalized cross-curved flow, then you know the solution exists all the time, and then you can show that metric become a round metric, just as we expect. And in the case of rich flow, it was also proved by Eisenberg and Jackson that, and the rich flow, the the metric converge to a round metric. So in both cases we have seen before, till now, the rich flow and the cross-curved flow works behave similarly.
And do you know of rate of convergence and uniqueness of units?
You mean in the rich flow?
No, in your flow.
Yes, because I have all the precise asymptotic behavior here, so I do know the rate of convergence. I didn't write that out. So
it's an exponential rate?
I don't think so. It's not. But you do can write out the rate of...
How do you see the limits? The limits are unique?
Because you have control of everything here, so...
Well, you said it's not exponential. When you look at normalized cross-curvature flow, it's over infinite time, it's not exponential.
Well,
it's not exponential,
but it's still, for example, it's polynomial or something. You can control, like 1 over t some.
Oh, so it's integrable.
It's integrable, yes. It's not exponential. I think in the case of rich flow, it's exponential.
Right.
Yeah, but I didn't think about this exponential convergence. Maybe I can work hard and get more. So the next case is sole geometry, and we can calculate the rich curvature and also the cross curvature. So you can see the equation looks more complicated now. So if you write out the cross-curvature flow here. And in this case, you can see, A and C are in a quite a symmetry position. So again, we have to work hard to estimate, to analyze the ODE system. So for any given initial metric, we can show that the flow exists up to some finite time, and then we can find the asymptotic behavior for all A, B, and C. And here, just as I reminded at the beginning, A and C look in a symmetrical position, so A and C actually has a similar asymptotic behavior.
So what was the geometry before when you had the same asymptotic?
That's SU2. So you can think that as a round metric on S3, as a SN.
Why is that
SU2? Say that again?
SU2 has the topology of
S3. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So that's why. But
I'm confused.
On S3, what
was
the isometric group?
SU2.
So the notation I'm using is the isometric group.
Okay. Yeah.
Sorry, it's bigger. It's SU2 cross SU2.
That's
but
right.
But the minimal transitive isometric is SU2.
Yeah.
Okay.
So. Now, in this case, if you look at the normalized cross-curvature flow, it still only exists up to some finite time. And here, you can always also look at the curvature. In fact, the curvature looks like, again, like 1 over 2 times square root capital T minus T. So the curvature blow up at the finite time. And so... Now let me remind you that for the case of rich flow on locally homogeneous three-manifold, if you consider the normalized cross-curved flow, the solution always exists all time. Okay, but here, even you consider the normalized cross-curved flow, it only exists up to finite time. And in the case of rich flow, the geometry developed what we call a cigar degeneracy, which means you have two diameter which shrink to zero and one other diameter increase to infinity, and then you have the curvature dies off. So let's talk about the case of SL2. 2R, which is the most complicated case, and in this case, in fact, we spend a lot of time analyzing the ODE. So we first calculate the rich curvature, and then the cross curvature tensor, and then we write the cross curvature flow equation like in the following. And then we can show for any, well, let me just remind you, if you look at the equation, B and C are in symmetrical position. So this is a case I was saying before. Even those two looks like in a symmetrical position, it does not necessarily mean that at the end they will have similar asymptotic behavior. So in this case, we have to separate them. If we start the initial condition B naught equal to C naught, then we can show that the solution for the cross curvature flow exists all time, and we can look at the equation and show A is increasing, and then we can also show that B and C are A is decreasing and B decreasing, but the limit is still a positive number. And BC are increasing and goes to infinity. Then you can write out the asymptotic behavior of A, B, and C. Now, in the case where you have B and C are not equal, so we just assume B naught is larger than C naught. Surprisingly, we will see the asymptotic, first, the solution only exists up to some finite time, and the asymptotic behavior of A and B are same, although B and C in the equation are in a symmetrical place. So A and B basically approach to zero, approach to infinity, and C approach to zero. Okay. So what we can see from the above asymptotic behavior is that means B equal to C, which does not characterize the typical geometry of the solution as we seen before. And in the case B is equal to C, if you consider the normalized cross curvature flow, then the solution does develop a pancake degeneracy, which in the case of rich flow, we know that the solution to the rich flow SL2R does develop a pancake degeneracy. Okay. Now, in the case B is larger than C, then we can also see that the curvature blows up, and like just like 1/2 times square root capital T minus T. So the last case is E2. So we can write we can calculate the rich curvature and also the cross curvature tensor. Then the solution, the equation for the cross curvature flow is the following. And here we can see A and B are in a symmetrical place. So for any given initial data, if you start A naught equal to B naught, then all the geometry, just look at the equation, you will see all the geometry will stay flat. Okay, and so of course the solution exists all time. And if we start A naught larger than B naught, then we can show the solution to the cross curvature flow actually exists for all time, and we can write out the asymptotic behavior for A, B, and C. So here you can see A and B approach to each other, but C goes to infinity. So the condition A equal to B, again, does not characterize the geometry of the general solution, because in the other case, C is state-bounded, but if A is larger than B, then C goes to infinity. And if you talk about the normalized cross-curvature flow, then we can see that the solution, again, develops a cigar degeneracy. And finally, let me remind you that in the case of rich flow, the rich flow on E2 actually converge to a flat metric. So I guess I stop here. Thank you.
Any questions? Well, I gather from so the all the assumptions are preserved under the cross curvature.
Yes. Yeah, I didn't mention that, but this is just okay. Like the just like the.
Typical model in there is unique.
So basically, the all the geometries are characterized by the constant epsilon k in that Milner frame.
Could you repeat the question?
Epsilon k in the Milner frame. You have f I f j.
Oh.
In the bracket.
Yes.
The different geometry corresponds to different choices of epsilon k.
Sure. Yeah, and. Like I said, all our calculations are based on that Milner frame.
I have one more question regarding the result that you mentioned before. It's this short time existence theorem where you assume that. Manifold is a closed three manifold with either positive or negative sectional curvature.
Yes.
Then you said that for any smooth initial metric, a solution to the closed curvature flow exists for a short time.
I mean, any smooth initial metric with positive or negative sectional curvature.
Thank the speaker again.
Thank you.
So we're going to take the speaker to dinner at 6 o'clock in Ming Dynasty. You're welcome to join us.
Hey, why is that not
the local anthropomorphic.
Locally,
but not locally. Well, SU2, Chris,
SU2. That's only when you look at the algebra, but as the group is there now.